Joanne Griffith spoke with Beats scholar Nancy Grace, professor of English at the College of Worcester in Worcester, Ohio. Nancy wanted to write her thesis on Jack Kerouac, but was forced to include Kerouac in a broader dissertation containing more acceptable writers.
Let's go back to the beginning, 1950s or late 40s, early 50s, United States, San Francisco in particular. Just give us a bit of a potted history of, you know, the foundation of the Beat Generation as we know it.
Right. Well, it's generally considered to have started around 1944 in New York City, when Jack Kerouac went to Columbia University and met Allen Ginsberg there. And then through Ginsberg, he met William Burroughs, and they also met a Times Square junkie named Herbert Hunky, who became kind of this iconic rebellious underground figure that I think fueled a lot of their imaginative literary work. So it was fundamentally an East Coast development, basically.
But came to be very much associated with San Francisco, didn't it?
It did, right. And San Francisco, you know, on the West Coast, certainly at that time was a much smaller city than it is now. Still had kind of a small town flavor to it. I mean, even though there were quite a few people living there, but it really was kind of on the edge of the world in terms of American culture, and had a long history of literary kind of bohemian communities thriving there because it was so off the beaten path. So the San Francisco Renaissance, which was the 1950s and late 40s literary revival at the time in San Francisco, kind of coincided with what Kerouac and Ginsberg and William Burroughs, as well as John Cleland Holmes, were doing in New York at the time. And then Kerouac, of course, with his cross-country trips, Ginsberg traveling quite a bit. I mean, they migrated out there and made a lot of contacts in San Francisco with the art community out there. Kenneth Rexroth in particular, Robert Duncan and Jack Spicer, many of those poets who were really the prime movers of what's known as the San Francisco Renaissance. So the Beat Generation and the San Francisco Renaissance really blended early on in the 50s.
Now, we often hear that the Beat Generation called different names. Like you've called them the Beats, and then later on, Beatniks.
Right.
What was the importance of how they were titled and how it changed? You know, I even read some places where people were like, well, you know, the Beats, they were just a bunch of bohemian hippies, really.
Right. Yeah, you do find that quite often. Well, the title or the term Beat Generation was developed by Jack Kerouac and John Cleland Holmes, based it off a phrase that Herbert Hunky had actually given them and said, you know, we're this beat generation. We're beaten down, we're worn down, you know, World War II, the Depression, the Cold War, you know, just everything in the middle of the 20th century was producing this just very weary, weary generation. So that's how those literary figures looked at it, kind of as a way of characterizing really the emotional content of their entire generation. But I think it also then became connected to this beatnik term, which a lot of the beat writers just didn't like at all and rejected.
Why was that?
Well, the beatnik term was invented by Herb Cain, a San Francisco journalist, columnist, and he created that based on the term Sputnik. And of course, at the height of the Cold War, to be connected in any way with Sputnik and, you know, the U.S. Russian or Soviet rather relations was considered a slight and certainly a negative term, and a lot of them just really rejected that entirely. So we're not beatniks because, you know, it was a diminuizing term. It really was a term that didn't carry much literary weight at all.
In terms of what influenced them, you talked very much about what was happening at the time, you know, kind of feeling kind of beat down and put down by social circumstances. As you mentioned, we had Jack Kerouac documenting his travel tales, as it were. But then people like Allen Ginsberg and William Burroughs with Naked Lunch and with Howl, respectively, it was far more sexual content, wasn't it?
There was a good deal of sexual content and intentionally kind of making visible kind of sexual realities that the culture had suppressed for such a long time. Kerouac did some of that, but not to the extent that Burroughs and Ginsberg did, definitely. And certainly in Howl, I mean, you see him kind of putting forward gay relationships and also things like just mental illness and saying this is something that can't be hidden any longer. We have to confront it. So there was really a bringing forward of a lot of ideas, concepts, realities that had been kept taboo, especially in kind of Puritan American culture for a long, long time.
There was another name within the Beat Generation movement who didn't write so much himself, but was referred to an awful lot. Mm-hmm. Neil Cassady.
Oh, right. The Muse.
Yeah. Tell us a bit more about him.
Yeah. Neil Cassady really was a figure that both Ginsberg and Kerouac gravitated towards as a brother figure, as a father figure in some way, as this iconic American hero, kind of a combination of cowboy, criminal, free spirit, also kind of, you know, sexually active, just this kind of amazing kind of iconic figure of sexual energy nonstop. So he becomes a figure, of course, in On the Road. He appears in Howl. He's in a number of the books. As again, this figure about which they, well, Ginsberg as well as Kerouac kind of meditate in a literary way. So he was a real figure that kind of explored for them kind of the breaking of boundaries, the testing of language, kind of taking them back to what they considered an authentic American voice. Kerouac really developed his writing style by reading Neil Cassady's letters. And Neil Cassady was just a fast talker in all sorts of ways, but literally just kind of talking a mile a minute. And he wrote the same way, and that influenced Kerouac's development of spontaneous prose. So he was a very, very important figure in terms of the development of their own writing and carrying forward a lot of important kind of themes in American history and bringing them up into the later 20th century.
Mm. One of the other things that really influenced the Beat poets, and one thing that that the Pacifica Radio Archives has preserved through many documentaries that have been done over the years about the Beat generation and the Beat poets, is the influence and the merging, I guess, with music, with jazz in particular, people like Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. I mean, why was there that marriage between kind of poetry and music at that time, do you think?
Well, I don't think it's unusual in artistic communities to, you know, cross boundaries, artistic medium boundaries. And there's a long history in many cultures of doing that. So I think with the Beats, I mean, they were doing what a lot of artists do. You know, they experiment and kind of move into different areas. With jazz, I think with Kerouac in particular, he had a real, I think, just an affinity for it. And when he went to New York City, you know, that was part of his education, basically outside Columbia, just exploring as many of the kind of underworld places and underground and just kind of soaking in as much of the culture as he could. I think it really complemented his idea of the function of poetry, which was to return to music and song. I mean, he continually spoke about that as some, you know, what artists really needed to do, particularly poets, was to get back to the essential nature of poetry, take it out of the academy, get it into the streets, and take it back to music and song. And I think he found in jazz a real representation of authentic American voices doing that, kind of creating poetry through through music that really created a transcendental experience, and it took you out of your bodily experience into a different place, which was his understanding of what poetry ought to do.
Let's just for a second turn our attention and focus to Allen Ginsberg. Mm-hmm. We mentioned Howl a little bit earlier on, and there was, I guess, a lot of conversation about how when right. when it kind of first came to people's attention, as we mentioned, for its sexual content.
Right.
What in particular did that artistic piece, that piece of poetry mm-hmm. do in terms of breaking down laws and sensitivities surrounding mm-hmm. Obscenity in literature?
It came at just the right time in terms of American history of American censorship law, actually.
Now that we're in, 2009, mm-hmm. some, I guess, 50 years after
right.
the start, 60 years almost, I guess,
right.
since the start of
the
Beat Generation. Mm-hmm. What do you feel has been their influence and their legacy?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think their writing in particular, just experimenting with different genres, breaking genre boundaries, which is a prominent characteristic of beat writing, as you mentioned, you know, incorporating jazz and other artistic mediums. I think that work has had a profound influence on, you know, what we see with literary studies today, or music. I think there's a lot of musicians, Bob Dylan, for example, you know, traces his roots back to Ginsberg and then to Kerouac and then to Pete Seeger. But there's been a lot of really important art that's been done since the Beats that comes out of their experimental work. And I think they still stand as maybe the last great literary artistic revolution in the United States. So we look back at them and say, here is a group that really did attempt to reconstruct the way we think about ourselves as Americans, and also about people of the world, too. But reconstruct the way we think about ourselves as Americans and reconstruct the way we think about the place of art in this world. And embracing kind of more experimental as well as more kind of futuristic ways of thinking about art. I think, for example, Jack Kerouac would have loved the internet and just being able to type and to, you know, send messages and to keep in contact with people the way we can now, which they just really couldn't do in their day. So I really think kind of the experimental ways of thinking about art and personhood and the place of self-expression in a culture, in a healthy culture. Because their work really did focus on self-expression and authenticity and trying to revitalize a world by revitalizing themselves through art and through religious practice as well. So I think we still are benefiting from that legacy.
And that does it for this week's edition of From the Vault. This series is produced by Brian DeShazer and Mark Torres, and executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and Brian DeShazer. We are now streaming and podcasting online at fromthevaultradio.org. Thanks for all the Pacifica listeners who joined our campus campaign and sponsored over 700 schools with our From the Vault series. For more information, call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the University of California Berkeley's Moffitt Library, the Pacifica Foundation, and from contributions from Pacifica Station listeners. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. I'm Brian DeShazer, and thanks for listening to The Beats today.